That afternoon, there was a party of tourists at the terrace, and looking down in the water among the empty beer cans and the dead barracudas, a woman saw a great, long, white spine with a huge tail at the end that lifted and swung with the tide while the east wind blew a heavy, steady sea outside the entrance to the harbor. "What's that?" she asked a waiter and pointed to the long backbone of the great fish that was now just garbage, waiting to go out with the tide. "Tiburon," the waiter said. "It's shark." He was meaning to explain what had happened. "I don't know sharks had such handsome, beautiful formed tails." "I didn't either," her male companion said. Up the road, in his shack, the old man was sleeping again. He was still sleeping on his face, and the boy was sitting by him, watching him. The old man was dreaming about lions. All right, that's the last page in Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea, which was our September book for our little book club. Every month, we read a book that is right around 100 pages long, and we enjoy it, we ingest it, we learn from it, and I'm digging having a few of you join the club, comment in. Just got a comment from Will Tote on Substack. Thanks, Will. Glad you're reading along, and come to the end of this book. The next book, starting October 1st, is going to be We the Animals, which has come highly recommended. So if you want to join for October, just head out to your local bookstore, get We the Animals, and start reading starting in October. Then you can head over to tierman.substack.com, and during the month, I'll just send 3 emails checking in with a passage from the book and a prompt to get you to think about it more deeply and write in if you would like. So that's what we're doing. Join if you want to. This is a re-uploaded podcast because it was just so damn good, and maybe some of you missed it. It's with one of my favorite surfers in the world, Peter Mell. Peter Mell was the 2011 Big Wave World Champion. He is all over the broadcasts of surfing, if you watch any of the World Surf League competitions, and he's just a very resolute fucking badass. That's all I got to say about Peter Mell. And had the chance to grow up in the same town with him in Santa Cruz. He was always intimidating but kind. That's the way I would describe Pete growing up. Intimidating but kind. He's just dedicated his life to the sport of surfing and has arguably paddled into the biggest best barrel of all time, which is a crazy fucking sentence to say. I'm sure that you have all seen the wave that he caught out at Mavericks 2 winters ago. On that emerald green, windless day, just paddled in from behind the peak, knifed it into a 50-foot double-up, and got blown out of a cathedral of epic proportions. I gotta go back and watch that thing just now, because it's making me get amped. Hopefully we have an El Nino winter, and more good waves to come for all you surfers out there. So that's it for now. Head to tierman.substack.com, sit back, relax, and enjoy this podcast with Peter Mell.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up. Thumbs up.
Welcome to the
Kyle Tierman Show.
That was pretty good.
Pete Mell in Starflight. Thanks for coming. Hey, I saw maybe the greatest surf clip I've ever witnessed on Kyle Boothman's computer.
that he got of you and your wave. And the wave was awesome, don't get me wrong. But he kept filming after you kicked out for a good 2 minutes, where you look down, you pump your fist, you look up, you smile, you look down, you pump your fists again. And it was such a personal moment that I was so happy that he just kept filming through the whole aftermath of that wave.
Yeah, and I think that I actually saw the clip as well.
It's great,
I have it.
Great clip.
It is. You talk about it, and I actually got a little chicken skin and relived the moment, quietly. You put a lot of time into something, and you visualize, you do all these things that you have to do in order to commit to something as much as we've committed to surfing and to a lot of things. But that was a culmination of all of that time and effort into a quick 20-second moment. It was a subtle elation, there's ways to claim things. I guess that was my way of claiming a very defining moment in my life. I hate to say one wave would define a moment, but all that, I've been surfing Mavericks since my first year was in 1991. And I've been putting in a lot of effort since then, and we're in, 2021? So that's 30 years of commitment to a single wave, and I try to surf it every year. And some years I put more effort into others. But that was a defining moment. I've been surfing and wanting to catch a wave like that for that 30 years. So it's just a culmination of 30 years of effort into a 10-second ride and whatever Kyle filmed after that.
Did you get did you paddle out that day with the intention to catch a wave like that?
Yes. I'd been putting in extra effort recently at Mavericks, and a lot of it's got to do with my son John and his commitment to Mavericks. And so we had made already this season. I think we got denied two times, or we drove up there wanting to surf, and there wasn't any waves. And those are dues paid, where you go wake up at 5. You get up there and you're sitting there and in the dark, and you're like, "Oh, we're going out. Oh, it sucks." Yeah. So, and we had put in a few more days before that. We were able to get a couple days in before that specific day, which, I think this specific day, December 8th, is going to go down in history as one of the best and biggest paddle days we've ever seen at Mavericks. So, again, I guess this, that commitment to the spot and the effort you put in, all of a sudden you have that moment. And I knew that that day specifically was going to be one of those special moments. You could see from the very beginning of the swell developing on the maps. And when you get there that day and the winds are the way they were and the day was the way it was and it started out pretty intense, I think one of the first things that at least John and Anthony was also there, which is my other child I've raised. He's my stepkid, but I've raised him since he was a year and a half old. So yeah. I've got responsibility there. And anyway, he was there too. And the first thing those guys saw was Luca Padua on a tow wave pack, a huge, 30 foot. When you say 30 foot, but really the face is much bigger than that, but a true big, massive wave. And we knew that this day was going to be special.
Yeah. Yeah. it's interesting to me how quickly a wave like the one that you got can go from this incredibly personal moment to, I'll first just say, going back before that day, we surfed out there the afternoon before, and it was a really eerie energy for me because the swell hadn't arrived, but the energy had, and you could sit out there and you could feel these lumps starting to move, but you could tell that the waves hadn't really organized themselves yet. But the raw power was there, and it took that next 12 hours to show up. And you got your wave maybe like 10 a.m.?
I think you know, the power lines guys, they had it actually time coded. But I think the very first wave I rode was around just after 9 o'clock. And then that second wave was just before 10.
Yeah. It's interesting to me how quickly a wave like that can go from this incredibly personal moment to a global media spectacle. Have you tracked at all in the days after the surf how the experience has, how your perception of the experience has shifted with media around it, if at all?
Usually when you see waves like that, all of a sudden the luster starts to kind of go away. You know, you watch it so many times, you're like, it's not that big.
Right. Yeah, it's like a song that you listen to too many times.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
It's like really quickly, all of a sudden, the dopamine is like, okay. Yeah. I used to love that song. Yeah. It was a great one for a week, and then I just wrung it out, and I can't listen to it anymore.
And, you know, I actually, it's funny you mentioned Kyle Boothman's footage, because he put a little reel together of some of my highlight moments recently. And we've actually had a lot of highlight moments at Mavericks. If you were to look and review the last few years, we've had some pretty incredible paddle days, you know, and a lot of the commitment to Mavericks specifically is that it is one of the best paddle waves in the world. So those biggest days, guys are trying to ride it and there's opportunities. And so we had 2017, we had that February day that was offshore.
Where all big Maui, offshore day.
Yep. Big offshore day. We've had, there was another day after that in 2018 that was on that second reef. And those days don't come very often. You know, I mean, I surfed it for 20 years and never, we saw a couple waves break out there, but it wasn't like there was a swell that said, oh, this is it. You know, and a lot of times, I guess when they're that big, in the 90s, we were on a tow rope, so we didn't really even think about that. We were just so enthralled with, you know, riding a 6-foot board in 30-foot surf, and we didn't focus on the paddle part. So I kind of like how, you know, because specifically Mavericks as a whole, to me, is the best paddle wave in the world. And the reason being is you got this really massive deep channel. You've got this shoulder that you can kind of work your way into it. Generally, the conditions are going to be, when it's that big, they're going to be smooth. And the opportunity to paddle into the biggest wave of your life is a place like that.
Was that the biggest wave of your life?
I would say, yeah. Paddling.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so cool.
It is pretty cool.
So cool.
And to do it at an age that I'm at now, it's pretty incredible because I didn't think I'd have another opportunity like that again. And I think the commitment that John's made, because I think that's really sparked the extra interest in it. And psychologically, that's the other part of it is, you know, are you ready to do it again? You know, like I could have easily sat there in that channel and said, the young guys can have it, but I didn't. And I can't say I put my finger on why all of a sudden that was the moment that I felt like I could go do it. It just felt right. And when it feels right, you know, you gotta
grab
go.
It. Yeah. You gotta grab those little energy balls when you got them. Does your surfing Mavericks with John change your relationship to the wave at all, or change the way that you approach those sessions in comparison to in the 90s when you were out there by yourself?
Yeah, I would say that's just by the virtue of growing older. I don't know if it's really necessarily the fact that John has, you know, changed that perception. I mean, obviously I analyze the wave. I'd like to think that I analyze the wave and the whole atmosphere the same as I did back in the day. I mean, when you're younger, you've got a little more raw approach. You're pretty much, you take higher risks. And, you know, nowadays I don't want to take those higher risks as much, you know, because you understand, you know, the dangers. So you obviously want to go out there and have a perfect session. So the only, I think age is really what changed the way I look at that wave.
Hmm. You made all your waves until in the afternoon, right when I was paddling in. I think I saw the one that closed out on you. Did you get super worked on that one?
No.
Really?
I didn't. It's so weird. That place is so weird to, you know, you can have, you know, some days, and I'll give you a comparison, is it? You know, that wave specifically, I knew paddling into it that I was too deep, but I had the ramp in, so I knew that I was going to get down the face. I mean, obviously, you want to try to make every single wave. That one, I knew that I probably was going to have to pay the price at the end of it all. But it was, you know, a different time of day. It was a little lower tide, so it was going to have, you know, it just wasn't going to allow me to get around the corner on it. So knowing that going into a wave like that, yeah, I just needed to get out in front of the lip. I did. But the thing, it was such a weird experience because I knew that I was going to get lit up. And when it landed behind me, generally it just explodes you and sends you flying. I was standing there and it exploded behind me and it left me in a little bubble.
Saw that. It exploded around you and then you kept riding.
Yeah.
Out in front of it.
And I was standing completely locked knees, yeah. Standing straight up going, this is so weird. And I'm in my head, I'm like going, it's going to eat me. I knew it was going to eat me at some point, but I had to, because usually when you're setting up for something like that and you know you're going to get worked, you take your breaths, right? You think, okay, so I'm going to, you know, get the oxygen into the system. But I actually had to take like three extra breaths and, you know, just because I was standing there and it hadn't taken me out yet. So there was a lot of, there was that moment. I mean, probably was only a half a second, but it felt like an eternity before it actually swallowed me up. And then once it hit me, I'm like, oh gosh, I'm going to get worked. I gotta pull my vest. And like, it's so hilarious, you know, and we've got these new inflation vests where you got these toggles on yourself that you can, you know, you hit a canister of, you know, compressed air and it inflates this vest and you're, you know, going to get to the surface. And I'm like, oh, and I'm like searching for my thing. I'm like, okay, I got to pop this thing. And all of a sudden I'm like, I get a hold of it and I go to pop it. And I'm like, I'm at the surface. And I still inflated the vest. And I was like, and I was already there.
Like, oh God.
Oh, that's horrible. And I'm like, I had to get back and then deflate it really quickly. But I wasted a can of air.
Oh, that's so funny.
And like, cause you're anticipating that you're going to have this an intense beating. And literally, I mean, I'm sure it was wild. I did get a little, like the very initial impact, I got a quick little jolt to the spine, like a, you know, because that place is very, very, very powerful.
Just all the energy goes into one spot right where that wave breaks. And it's incredible the amount of power that is being funneled into just a little forbidden zone there.
Yeah. And the reef itself as a whole is very uneven, which I think that's a big reason why it's so dangerous, is that you can get put into a zone where you're not coming to the surface for a long time, even with an inflation vest. I mean, there's these holes that'll hold you down. And I've been in a situation before where I've been held down for two waves, a couple times at Mavericks. But sometimes it's one of those things where it literally explodes you to the surface.
Right.
And that's kind of what happened on that wave number three for me that day, was that it hit me and at some reason blew me to the surface, and I inflated my vest as I'm at the surface, which is so hilarious.
Where are the deep spots in the reef? Like, where have you had your worst beatings? Has it been on inside waves or on outside waves?
It feels to me, I mean, if you could take your hand, right, and let's say the outside of your hand and your pinky side, right, and that's going to be facing west, which is, you know, you have these ridges that run off your fingers and they're deep ruts. You know, you look at the reef as a whole, it's just this ruts that come out of the, you know, the surface of the earth. And then there's these big long holes that run down the edge of the reef. So, and that's when you watch the wave, it'll lift on the shallow spot, drop a little bit, lift again, drop a little bit, lift again. And that's how that wave is. And so if you get into one of those little ruts, the water just kind of spills off the shallow part, goes into the deep hole and spins down there and kind of keeps, you know, you held down there. And that's where, so the main bowl has that shallow spot and then it has off the edge. I think if you're going left, maybe you get pushed into one of those areas off the reef there, because it goes pretty deep on the left hand side. It'll go into a good 40-foot hole. That's a dangerous area. And then the actual second explosion into that second rut that comes off the main bowl, if you're off of that, that's an area that I think if you look at watching some of the wipeouts that have happened that ended up being, you know, a death for a surfer out there, i.e. Mark Fu, in his wipeout, he felt like, for me, it felt like he hit his stomach when he fell. And so maybe he got some air knocked out of him. And so he didn't have a good breath. But also Scion was kind of off the bowl. And he was in that second area that went into that area that'll hold you down. And I feel like those are the danger areas.
Hmm. Yeah. Do you have a wipeout that you can think of that was particularly bad? You mentioned like you've had some wipeouts out there.
My very first two-wave hold down was on a day, maybe an 8 or a 9 at 17, smaller day, breaking on the bowl, low tide. I tried to push it underneath a low tide one and didn't make the drop. And I feel like that was the one where it goes off the kind of the left side of the bowl and it goes into the deep spot off the main bowl right when you first wipe out. That was an area where, I mean, I vividly remember going, getting the wipeout and going, okay, the energy is kind of subsiding. I'm ready to go to the surface, and then getting dropped into that rut or that hole in the reef and going really deep. And you can feel yourself, the pressure starts to get stronger. So you know you're deep. And that's, I remember just going, whoa, I haven't been this deep before. And the energy of the wave's not going to let me up again. So at this point, you know, psychologically, I'd never been in a situation like that. Psychologically, do you, oh my gosh, you panic, right? Which is, I've had a similar situation at another break I'll tell you about, where the switch went the opposite direction. But that moment, I was able to go, oh, I'm going to be down here a little while and relax, you know, and that was something that I had never had to experience before. And you don't know until you actually get in that situation how you're going to deal with it psychologically. And in that moment, I was just like, oh, it's cool. Okay, I'm going to be down here a little while. So I relaxed. I didn't try to swim to the surface or anything like that. So I sat down there and then I heard the next wave. So I was like, oh, yeah, you hear it. And I just was, well, I can't swim up into it. So I just waited and the next wave rolled over the top of me and it kind of brought me to the surface, gave me a little breath and brought me down again. So I was down 45 seconds. You know, there was Steve Spaulding, which is a longtime photographer, filmer. From the area, he filmed it all and he filmed the whole thing. So he actually put a timer on it and it was like, oh, okay. So it's like 44 seconds,
yeah,
which is a long hold down for surfing.
For sure.
But all of us can hold our breath for a minute. Yeah. You know, anybody pretty much.
Why is air a lot like sex? Cause it's no big deal till you're not getting any.
Yeah. Right. And, so that was one situation. I was like, whoa, I just had a 2-way hold down and it wasn't, you know, that bad. I can do it. You know, I always heard about those situations over the years that people have had it. And some people like have stopped and stepped away from a place like Mavericks or, you know, after a situation like that, I was able to gain confidence from it. There was another situation, like the opposite of happened to me. I was with, my best man and tow partner at the time was Adam Replogle. We were exploring some new spots around the world. We were in a place that has actually taken a surfer's life, Pete Davy, you know, it's Pescadero Point. We were towing that wave for the first time and I had a wipe out there and the unknown, I guess, in my mind is what I actually had a life vest on. You know, and that 2-wave hold down I talked about previously, we were in a situation where we just wore wetsuits. We didn't have any life saving, you know, apparatus anywhere. But this one I was tow surfing. I had a full on life jacket on. And I got a wipeout. Similar situation where the bottom's super uneven. And, you know, it when the bottom's uneven like that, it you have those spots that the water just holds you down. So that was one of those situations where I was like, oh, gosh. And I remember in my head in that moment going, the next wave's coming. I got to get to the surface. And that switch of my mind psychologically to I need to get air now really screwed me up. 'Cause all of a sudden, I was panicked. I was very fortunate that I got to the surface before the next wave. But if I hadn't, I probably would have lost my air and had to be resuscitated by Adam, which I would have come to the surface at least because I had a life jacket on. But that was where psychologically I was like, wow, I never want to do that again because it was scary. And it put me in a situation where I'd never been before.
Yeah, it's interesting how the need to be somewhere else is what causes the most suffering.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you can actually be okay where you are, the human psyche can handle mm-hmm. immense suffering if you're able to give up that war for a little time, the war of air, the war of a relationship, mm-hmm. a war of like a job, a war of like wanting to be in some other situation is what...
It's stress.
It's the stress that we can't handle, right?
Stress as a whole is one of the most unhealthy things we could possibly deal with. Yeah, it's a teacher, but it's also... you know, it's also one of the worst things you could possibly, it's suffering.
Right. And being able to give that up, right? Like what you said in the first situation at Mavericks, like, okay, I'm going to be here for a little while, allows you to be there for probably, you know, it probably allows you to be there longer than you ever thought you could, mm-hmm. right? But it's just that switch of wanting to be somewhere else, which I think is, I mean, as looking at this concept on a meta level, like, a huge affliction in global society right now, given the amount of constant comparison that we have to everyone else on social media, for instance, right? And the amount of suffering that that simple mental switch of comparing yourself can cause.
Yeah.
I think that that's where mindfulness comes in, right? Yeah. Like that's the power that those, that mindfulness can offer people.
So true. And again, I talk about the teacher in my life. The real life experiences are really the best teachers. We can go to classes. You could have mentors. You can have all these people tell you something, but you can try and practice that. But the best teacher is obviously that real life experience with the chemicals flowing through your body and the emotion that comes with it. You don't want to have those situations where, you don't pull it, right? And so far, I've been very, very fortunate that most of my situations I've been in have been great teachers.
Right. How has adversity been a teacher to you?
Well, I mean, if you could put it to those moments in surfing right sure. there, right? Those are the big wave elements. There's competition parts, right? If I was competing and wanting to be the top surfer in the world and be on the championship tour, those lessons of having to accept the fact that I was never going to get there. That's a teacher. Relationships, drugs, that was a big thing for me. I had to overcome that. And all those, the real life experiences, were the greatest teachers.
Right.
And I had, there's some psychological moments that I dealt with when I was dealing with drugs and alcohol that I wouldn't be here today if I didn't get to experience those things real life. Again, going to a rehab and having people tell you those stories helps, but the real true teacher is the experience that you deal with inside. And then, the repercussions of afterwards, having to deal with it, whether, you've screwed up a relationship that you cared about or, you got in trouble, you went to jail, who knows? I mean, I was very fortunate that I didn't have to deal with that, but, again, this dealing with real life experiences is the best thing going.
Yeah. Do you ever coach yourself? Like, do you, there's a the Stoic Marcus Aurelius, he was the emperor for years, and he kept this journal, and he would actually talk to himself like, okay, like, Marcus, get it together, dude. Like, this is your time. You're going to show up. We're in a famine. Like, you got to show the fuck up today. he actually spoke to himself like he was his own coach. Do you ever have those level of conversations with yourself in situations of adversity?
Psychologically, when I'm strong, yes. When I'm not, when I'm in autopilot or I'm distracted or not in the now, yes, that's I don't talk to myself, and that's the worst place you can be. So being able to acknowledge that in those moments, which is very hard to do for a lot of people, and to be able to just grab yourself and go, shake yourself and go, what are you doing? You can't think like this, I do. Yes. And that's when I'm healthy, but I'm not always healthy. If you're not taking care of yourself, whether it be, with diet or, psychologically asking yourself those questions, to keep yourself healthy. I still do it. Even at 51, I still have those moments where I go into autopilot and I'm not thinking and I'm not in the now. I'm either thinking about the future and like what I can get, what I need, or I'm in the past going, you screwed up. You're such a little pathetic mess. I still do that.
Yeah.
But right now, in this moment right now, I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah. Do you ever trip out on you said been surfing Mavericks for 30 years?
About
30 years.
Yeah. I mean, 2021's next year, so this season, 29 years, let's say.
How do you feel about time at this point in your life? Like, does it feel like a flash that you were out there? You know, that amount of time between when you first went out there to now? Like, how is your relationship to time shifted, being the geriatric that you are today?
Thanks, Kyle.
Yeah, just had to go there.
Yeah. I guess in some moments, yeah, it feels like a flash, but then sometimes it feels like a really long time ago. Again, I think that also kind of is attuned to how I'm psychologically feeling today. You know, when I'm healthy and psychologically healthy, the reflection is good. When I'm not healthy, it feels like I'm old. Yeah. You know, but I don't like I said, that specific day, December 8th, was one of those days where I was psychologically sound, and I couldn't put a finger on why that was the case. Maybe it was the atmosphere of the people I was with, you know, the environment I was with. It could have been the environment of the energy in the water, because I feel like that specific day as a whole, for me, I wasn't rushed. Because generally that's one of my biggest flaws is I need to be here. I got to be there now. But I didn't feel that that day.
It also wasn't that crowded for how good it was. I felt that everyone was able to get their waves throughout the day when they wanted them.
Yeah, if you wanted a real one, they were there to be had for sure. And you're right. And I think a lot of it's got to do with the way things are right now as far as traveling goes. And, people just can't jump on a plane as easy as you can and do a red eye. It's like, you know, you got to have a test and this, that, and the other. And so
From Hawaii, I think it was really just Kai Lenny and Ian Walsh who came over, maybe a couple other guys. But
JoJo.
I guess, yeah,
JoJo and Luca.
Those guys had come over from the Jaw as well. Yeah.
They had come over and did quote unquote red eyes. But they'd come from the Jaw as well. Yeah. So, but it's a nightmare, really. They had issues with trying to get their boards on the plane, which usually isn't a big deal, but for whatever reason, due to COVID and the travel restrictions that are happening, it's more difficult. I think the commercial airlines are subsidizing the loss of seats with probably cargo, is my assumption. I have no idea if it's really truly the case, but I think those planes are filled with a lot of stuff because getting stuff around the earth right now is difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at UPS or FedEx or any of the, delivery agencies, it sucks. You know, you can't get stuff. So I feel like that's what's happening. I could be completely wrong. I have no idea. It's the assumption, but.
Dude, I'm so out of it. I haven't been on a plane in a year.
Same.
It's insane.
And my whole life was on a damn plane.
Yeah.
So it's actually been really nice.
It's really nice. I love living in this RV. Yeah. Dude, I went up on the first swell at Mavs, where we got those 2 days, maybe a week prior, drove up in Starflight, slept on the side of the road, you know, went out, got 3 sessions. I felt like I was on a surf trip. It totally changed my relationship to that wave. Like, you know, done that drive a million times from Santa Cruz to Half Moon Bay, you surf, you come back, but staying the night, you know, like reading a book, like in the parking lot, you're like, oh, the next morning it's going to be good. It was really cool to see how much that little mini like vacation satiated my need for travel. You know, when I start to get itchy feet and I feel like I need to start traveling, like turns out I don't need to travel halfway around the world to get that same feeling.
No. Well, you've gotten yourself a good atmosphere here in the Starflight.
Oh yeah. It's great.
It helps.
But dude, that the morning of the big day, Chachi, great surf photographer, came up with me, slept on the floor here, blew him up a little air mattress, woke up the next morning, and we were planning on launching the ski. And as I was launching it, we didn't properly take the back strap off. We just let it loose as I was reversing it out of the dock there, and it sucked it up. And we had a fucking horrible time, like trying to get the rope out, couldn't do it for like an hour. So then I'm like, all right, Chachi, like you're going to shoot from the beach and I'm just going to paddle out. So I drove Starflight to the Mavs parking lot, and the first one was full. The second one still had a spot, and I was reversing in and I fucking dropped it into a ditch. And then I had to get towed out. This is all like the morning before I'm planning on going out there. So my whole morning got entirely screwed up.
Is there a moment where you could say what was happening? Was there an energy that kind of, was it rushed?
I was rushing it.
Yeah.
I was totally rushing it.
So that's the thing.
Totally rushing it. Yeah. Like you want to get.
I got to get out there.
Because we were at the launch ramp at first light because we wanted to get out there so early. And now the clock's ticking. Like, and you know those days where it's like you don't know if the wind's going to come up. Mm-hmm. You don't know if you're going to just have that little, you know, that little moment. And so I rushed myself, dropped it into a ditch, had to get towed out. And then finally, when I was on the beach, I remember taking an extra like 10 minutes of just like breathing, getting myself back in order, because I made a commitment to myself that I was not going to paddle out still feeling rushed, because I could see it. I could see how big it was. And right when I was coming in, Taylor Paul had just come in and he was like, dude, it's for real out there today. It's a very big day. And I took my time going out and then got to kind of ease my way into it. So I was very proud of myself for having started off like at negative 10 and been able to, and slowly worked my way up into having a fun session.
Yeah. And you could have easily turned around and walked away.
Right.
Which is what kind of Chachi did, right?
Yeah.
Right. He, in his mind, he went the opposite direction and just said, screw it, I'm out of here. And was frustrated for that and probably a little bit resentful afterwards, right? Because he wasn't able to turn it around and felt like he missed out on that. And that FOMO thing is one of those things where, you know, that's, you know, none of us should be dealing with. When I say FOMO, it's fear of missing out, right?
Right.
And that's something none of us should ever feel. It's not a healthy mental state. So I found that, and I, a lot of my years of my life, I was always... that fear of missing out was something that I sat with for a lot. And that's a lot of the reasons why I had some of the issues I've had, you know, I believe.
How so?
You're comparing, right? You're comparing yourself to something, you know, and as much as that can be a drive for you, it's a super negative thing in my mind to have to want to be compared to the Joneses, right? I mean, for lack of a better term, I mean, I guess an example would be for me and Mavericks and my relationship with Mavericks and Daryl Verosco, Flea, right? Like, you know, he was the one guy that I would always try to compare myself to, and I was always trying to one-up him, you know, and whether it be out in the water comparing myself to him surfing, you know, doing the biggest air when we were, you know, best photo, like all of that stuff that is not necessarily healthy. If I were to take my mental capacity that I have somewhat now and know this and bring it back to when I was younger, I think I would have, you know, I would have probably not had to deal with, you know, the fact that I used to drown my issues with, with the alcohol or drugs. Right. Because it was just that uncomfortable feeling that I was trying to quell. And now I can kind of get through it without having to worry about that. It's like, you know, I can take a breath, or I can have a chat with somebody that can help me to see it, or, you know, I have all these other tools that you can use to quell that anxiousness.
Yeah, look at the obituary page of all these important people and realize that no one remembers really anything that we do, so it's better to just enjoy ourselves.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And are you spending, you know, now you're spending, you were gone, you know, doing the WSL thing for a while. Are you still going to be doing that this year when it gets started back up?
I was asked to go to Maui for the women's, so I was going to go do that event. I had some circumstances here that had me make the decision to stay in town and not go over there. You know, and again, there's that FOMO feeling of like, oh my gosh, because I really do enjoy doing the commentary for the WSL. First of all, because I love watching good surfing, I love the competition part of it, to watch people and, you know, sport. So that part of it's cool. And to be able to analyze it and bring my own experiences into those situations and talk story, really.
You're very good at it.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoy doing it. And I think that's what comes across more than anything. So I was worried that I was going to feel so missing out. Oh, gosh, it sucks, you know. But actually, in a way, I was kind of like, oh, this is cool. I can enjoy it from watching it from afar. And I wouldn't have been there for December 8th had I not been there. So weird circumstance, right? I made a decision that I stood with and I was okay with. And, you know, the universal powers allowed me to be in a situation like I was on December 8th with strong.
Can you actually watch, say, the pipe contest and enjoy it? Or are you just constantly critiquing the production of it?
Oh, no, I totally enjoy it. Of course, I'm going to have my, well, no, I don't think that, you know, my, yeah. my own opinion on something. But no, I'm not going, you know, nitpicking it to galore. I want to see the WSL and the World Surf League succeed. You know, I want to see this opportunity for, because there's so many ways, and I mean, especially nowadays, to watch and witness and be a part of surfing. For me, live competition is a very unique thing that you can't get otherwise, unless you have it. We can watch vlogs, you know, and watch people be characters and see personalities, which is a great part of it as well. But I feel like you need it all, kind of like you need to be able to see that kind of stuff. You know, I see edits from kids and watch what they're doing. But the live competition part of it is something that I think we would dearly miss if we didn't have it.
It's the arena. It's where we get to see it's where we get to see the best athletes of our sport deal with the most amount of adversity in the moment with the biggest audience.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, are you actually going to be able to handle that pressure of having all these eyes on you and have the clock ticking down and be able to perform? And to be able to see that is, it doesn't matter what sport it is. It's just the human potential in those moments is really awe-inspiring.
Yeah. And again, we'd miss it if we didn't have it. So I want to see the WSL succeed. And it's been very difficult for them to get through all of this. I mean, we've got a sport that's international, and you know, right now traveling is very difficult, you know, like, you know, and dealing with the fact that these, you know, they're testing every day, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, this COVID, you know, you're sick, and all of a sudden you're like, a guy could be coming up for his day of the heat and he takes a test, and all of a sudden you're like, sorry, you tested positive and now you are quarantined and we're going to put you in a room. You're now in jail for 2 weeks.
So the guys can't surf if they test positive.
Oh, no, they can't, you know, and that's part of the protocols which are in place. So it's very challenging. I mean, you look at what's happening with basketball, football, you know, games are canceled. Like, it could easily, I mean, we had the Pipe Masters suspended because of positive COVID tests, and that can happen pretty much at any day.
Man.
So to have them pull it off and actually crown a champion and actually have the competition that we did have on that final day, last day of the waiting period, you know, they were up against the wall. They let how many days had to go by of perfect surf at Pipeline that they didn't get to compete in.
Because of the positive COVID test. Yeah, wow.
Yeah. So it's like, to have them pull it off is a huge, huge blessing. And, you know, and to watch it was really fun to watch, man. It was great competition. You know, the fact that you have the two best Brazilian surfers in the world, you know, up against each other in the semifinal with Italo and Gabriel. And then you have the grand poobah of surfing in the semifinals, Kelly Slater, up against John Florence, who arguably is the best surfer at Pipeline in the other semi. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better setup. It was awesome.
Yeah, so good. And how weird was it to see John walking up the beach, winning his first Pipe Masters, and there's very few people around him?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the crowd is... I was curious if that changed his feeling about the win. Like, you're around that kind of energy when someone wins a contest and they're carried up the beach and there's this sea of people around them.
Yeah.
What is it like to see that?
An example being is you go to last year and watching, you know, Italo against Gabriel in the final of the Pipe Masters, going for the world title, one heat, like that energy, that, and the beach is packed. Everybody's focused on it. the surfers that are able to tap into that energy, because absolutely you feel the energy from the crowd. An example being just even kicking out in the channel after my wave and having all these boats erupt in applause like that. And that was part of the reason I think that that moment where you saw me reflecting was just like soaking that in.
Yeah.
Because I don't get that. You don't have that happen to you, or someone's literally, everyone is so stoked. I mean, I remember hearing John's screaming, "Oh my God, Dad, that was so sick." You know, and he's screaming and everybody was clapping and like, that's a moment.
Yeah.
Right. And he didn't get that. John Florence did not have that moment, I don't think. That energy of everybody clapping and cheering and being so proud of him for that moment. So I think he did miss out a little bit on that. I don't think it's going to affect him very much.
No.
He's going to be fine. But I mean, I guess it's a little bit of a missed opportunity. And I think it's kind of a selfish thing too. I mean, I don't think people need to have that to survive, but
no,
it's pretty cool.
But the feeling of winning for athletes is like dissecting that feeling is interesting to me, because you spend your entire life working up to that moment, right? John Florence has never won a Pipe Masters. He's been thinking about that since the time he could walk, right?
Oh, no, his first, like, there's shots of him in his first Pipe Masters, and I remember that. He was like, I think he was 12 years old when he surfed his first Pipe Masters, and it was he rode for O'Neill or Vans maybe, and they gave him a wild card or something into it. And he was just a little toe-headed Grom, dude. He was never going to win the event, but they gave him the opportunity to feel it, you know? And so it took him, 20 years to finally win one, right? And you know, he didn't want to have that little burden sitting there probably at the end of his career going, wow, I surfed how many Pipe Masters and I was, didn't win one? I mean, again, it's not something that is a huge deal to somebody. I don't think he's, yeah, but you focus on a career, you have goals.
Right.
And so that would be basically a goal that he didn't achieve. There were some great interviews that the WSL had did before that with John talking about how important it was to him to win an event that he grew up on that beach. And, it's an example for me, I guess I could correlate to the fact that we have this, the Coldwater Classic or the Lane, to be able to compete in that event and get a win and win that event. That's like a goal I had. And wow, I was very fortunate that I was able to achieve that goal. Of course, that was 97 and it's a long time ago. And that memory's, it didn't change my life, right? But you achieve a goal. And I guess it does correlate to the rest of your life and feeling content, with a career, I guess, in professional surfing or just as a whole in life.
Right. And now we're going to have CT again back at the Lane coming this year. I'm sure you'll commentate for that.
I would hope so. Right. If they're, you can't get commentators. I mean, example being, I think is the hardest part is that, Europe's a little easier to get to, I guess, for America, but Oz has been very restrictive in regards to how their traveling's happening. If you can leave Oz, but getting back in is very challenging. I mean, example, Ace Buchan, right? He was, he's on the championship tour, but he had to make a decision that he wasn't going to leave his family for 3 months. If you're going to travel as a professional surfer, you're allowed to bring one person. Right. And he's got a family of three, a wife, like he wasn't willing, the importance of his family was more important to him than to go surf the Pipe Masters. Yeah, he didn't compete because of the restrictions that are happening there, because he would have had to leave, miss Christmas, miss the New Year's, hang out in Hawaii through it all. And the competing wasn't as important as taking care of his family as a new baby. And that's a lot of respect for him to make that decision, because it was very unselfish for him to do that. I hope that he's able to come to surf at the Lane. At some point he's going to have to start to get out of there. But it's challenging times.
Have you seen pro surfers' careers change as a result of having kids?
Yeah.
I've heard Joe Rogan talk about how when fighters have kids, he thinks they get better. They become more focused. Their goals become more solidified. They can kind of dedicate themselves to their child and to their family in a more honed way. But I think that obviously it can have the opposite effect, where all of a sudden you can't be as selfish as you once were. And sometimes that selfishness is what it takes to do something like win a world title.
Agreed. Yeah. I think that it's a two-edged sword there. And I think the maturity and being able to work it out, right? And I think the partner is a huge part of it too. Like if your partner's supportive, and then I think that helps, you know, for example, being the people that have taken that, you know, dad power, they like to call it, right? The dad power. That's the support of, you know, the partner and as a collective to focus directly on the career at hand and using that as a way to energize yourself and to create focus and to, you know, give you energy. You know, the opposite side effect is if you're, you know, your partner's struggling with you having to travel or having to be away from the family, and it's all of a sudden it becomes something where it hurts. It's hard for you to be away. And I think he's had to experience that through it all too. I mean, he's probably left his family at times. I'm talking about Ace again, where, you know, he realized it wasn't fun, right? And so he's got to go, okay, I'm going to get my priorities in line. Again, experiences in life that teach you these things. You're like, whoa, that wasn't that cool. I spent 2 months away from my family. And I mean, I know, for example, for me personally, when I used to travel away from my kids, you know, and you leave for 3-4 weeks at a time, and all of a sudden you come home and your kid's grown, like, and you missed it. And that, that's important. At least it is important to me that you don't miss those moments that are key moments. So, you know, again, I talked about the two-edged sword. So you just, it's a experience, you learn from it, and you put those priorities in line, and you develop your life around it.
How old were you when you had John?
So that would have been, he's 21 right now. So I'm 51. I was 30.
30.
For John. Yeah. But Anthony is 28. So, I stepped into a fatherhood role in my early 20s, around 23. You know, I met my wife Tara at around 21 years old, you know. So she had already had a child, which was Anthony, from a previous marriage. So I kind of stepped into that relationship being not necessarily a father, but I was taking a role. Yeah, I was changing diapers, you know. So, and babysitting, you know, and spending time with Anthony. And, you know, in that era of at that time, I was pretty full on in my quote unquote career of, you know, traveling a lot. And a lot of times I think that those experiences were super cool because I was able to bring my family with me. You know, I brought Anthony and brought Tara along, but there was times where I missed out too, where, you know, I was gone for a month and a half or 6 weeks at a time. And I mean, I missed my son's first birthday, like, and that's one of the most important birthdays you could possibly have for a child. And I was in Tasmania, of all places.
Historically, too, that's really big because child mortality rate was so big throughout history. Like in, I believe it's in Hawaii.
Yeah, Polynesian culture.
Polynesian culture, the first birthday is huge.
Yeah,
right?
Gigantic. Yeah. And I, in a very selfish state at that point in my life, I was my career and I got to go do this. And I missed that. And I have to sit with that one, you know, you know, John, I think, is okay with it. But, you know, I'm kind of a bummer because I think in that moment, I probably now I would have made a different decision.
Hmm. Yeah. But at the same time, it's so important to keep your own autonomy as a man, even through dadhood, right? I think that that's another fear that a lot of people have. Personally, I don't have kids. I'm 30, but I think I want kids, and I'm also afraid of losing my autonomy, like the things that I love to do. And I know that it can complicate situations.
Well, it's an investment.
It's an investment. Yeah.
Huge investment in time, you know, money, emotionally.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a huge
investment.
Right.
So it's definitely, in my opinion, it's worth it. Right.
Why?
Because they're like, and I guess, for me, I'm able to share this moment with John, right? Like
getting the biggest wave of your life and having your son right there on the shoulder.
And him be genuinely stoked. And I'm doing the same for him.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm there in the channel when he kicks out of his biggest wave of his life.
Yeah, he got a bomb.
Yeah, and we're sharing these moments together. And like, if I'd done it later in life, I guess, I probably wouldn't be able to share a moment like that.
Right.
Right? So I didn't know at the time when I was jumping into that, you know, to do it fairly young because I got married pretty young. You know, I jumped into a fatherhood role very young, and I tried to juggle it all. And that was probably tough, you know, and I think that psychologically, yeah, my own investment in my career, I tried to do it all. And, you know, I hurt people along the way. I hurt myself sometimes, and I hurt maybe my career sometimes, and I also hurt my family sometimes because of it.
Hmm. Yeah. I hear what you're saying around being able to share those moments with someone who you know so deeply. The way that I think about it is, like, there's, like, you and I meet a lot of people, right? We're traveling a lot. We have a huge network of friends.
Yeah, I work in a retail.
Work in a retail. Yeah. People, hey, Peter Mel, yeah. Right? Like, you're meeting people all the time, and there are these different levels of knowing people, right? And there are people who I've met who I felt I had an incredibly deep connection with right off the bat. However, there's no way I could truly know that person because we haven't been through any situations of adversity together. I believe that it actually takes time to get to know someone for you to really drop into that next layer of depth and go through hard situations together and see how they react, see how you react, and then something deeper and beautiful can give way through that, right? And that's something that it feels important to me, like in this lifetime, because our culture doesn't really, our culture doesn't romanticize or put value on those relationships. Like, you look at social media, it's about like, what's the number of followers that you have, right? What's the number of, like,
which is dangerous in my opinion, right?
Super
now.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
Super dangerous, right? So you have all these very tenuous connections with people who you don't really know. And you feel, and it's like people, you kind of know a bunch of people, but there's no one who you can, like, who can you really call when shit gets hard?
Well, I mean, right? for you, like, what about siblings, right? Is a sibling going to be someone like, I'm an only child, right? So I never have that deep connection with a sibling that where they truly know you, probably know the emotions you're feeling, and, you know, whether you've gone through the adversity of a, you know, parenthood, you know, parents abusing you, whatever it is, or parents being very supportive of you, being able to share that with a sibling. I didn't have that, right? So, you know, I missed probably that deeper connection, you know, and in friends too, right? So do you have that relationship with a friend that's that key, right? And I personally, probably the only person I have it with now in my life is my children and my wife. That I, you know, they know me, right? they know everything about it. And being able to be comfortable having those things, you know, those getting through the adversity or getting through the joy, with them, because sharing it's pretty cool.
We're social animals, man. And I am very lucky in that I am the youngest of five, you know, a bunch of half older brothers and sisters, but we all grew up in the same house together. We're on the Midtown right now. I was born on Cayuga Street, just two blocks over, and we all lived, you know, in a house together. And it's funny, you know, this summer I was out in Montana and I invited my big brother Toby out, 7 years older than me. And he's someone who he taught me how to surf, taught me how to skateboard. We've always had a good relationship, but it's also been very competitive. And, like, very commonly I would just take digs at him. He would take digs at me. And there's always been this level of just competition, right? That I think made it difficult for us to really just, like, compliment each other every now and again. And he came out to Montana and we did a fly fishing trip. I wrote a story about this and we ate psychedelic mushrooms together. And I, in a single moment, was able to look at that competition that I had with him and realize that there was some level of unhealthiness to it, and realize that I actually just fucking respect this dude. I have a ton of admiration for him. I wrote the story and gave it to him, and then it appeared in a few different magazines and stuff. And I think that it was, like, a paramount moment in helping to heal our relationship. And since then, like, our relationship has gotten much better. And it made me realize how, you know what, like, when you have siblings, you're going to be with them for the rest of your life. So it's worth it to invest in those relationships so much more than it would in some relationship that you have with a stranger on Instagram.
True. Right?
There's right. only so much attention and energy that we can give.
If you don't
so
like the relationship, you can just unfollow. Right.
Right. Exactly.
It's that simple.
You can't unfollow your brother.
No,
right.
No. Or your parents. Right. So it's like if you're in a situation where you're feeling, you know, you don't have a great relationship, it's probably a good thing to try and at least communicate about it so that you can figure it out and get through it and be okay with it.
Right.
You know, whether it's going to work or not work, but. You are going to have to deal with it.
Yeah. And you're not destined to have the same relationship with people that you had when you were younger.
Absolutely.
Right? People change. And I think that to believe that you are this constantly evolving, growing being with the experiences that you have, a lot of the adverse experiences that you have that help you grow into a new person, mm-hmm. it's never worth it to... see yourself in that past view, right? And feel sentenced to that version of yourself or someone else too.
Yeah.
I think that that's one of the hardest things about people who, you know, maybe were former addicts or people who used to be in prison. Like their community can still see them in that past version of themselves, and it can be more difficult for them to grow out of it, which is why often it takes people physically moving to a new place mm-hmm. to have that growth occur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, acceptance of it too, right? I think there's acceptance of a relationship that's good or bad. And actually being able to grow from it is the biggest, most important thing from, in my opinion. You know, that's why, I mean, I've been married for, you know, 25 years. And so, and we've had to work through a lot of stuff. And I feel personally right now the closest I've ever felt with my wife because I've had to deal with all the adversity that and acceptance. And it's great, you know, in this moment it's great. I mean, I hope it stays that way, you know. But again, we always are kind of evolving and changing. You know, the communication through it all is important.
Mm. Yeah. And you are... spending a lot of time at this shop, Freeline. Did your dad start Freeline?
Yes.
When did he start Freeline?
So the surf shop was started in 1969, the year I was born. So wow. My parents moved actually from the North Shore. My dad and mom were, you know, kind of hippie. They were doing, you know, my dad basically was a surfer and was going to do everything he could to keep surfing. You know, what else do you do at that time in that era?
He was a shaper.
He would start making surfboards.
John Sr.
Yep. He'd start making surfboards and, you know, he was doing it in Hawaii. He was on the North Shore doing it. My mom was selling Avon. You know, it wasn't the, best atmosphere, I guess, for the both of them. And they ended up in that, you know, late '60s decided, you know, they had heard about Santa Cruz and, they came here and put some roots down and the shop opened up. Right on Portola, actually, was the very first store was where Blown Out Wetsuit Repair is now,
yep.
Right? Literally that little 600 square foot shop was Freeline Surf Shop. That next year, they ended up moving on to 41st Avenue. They got a house. It's where I grew up. So I grew up in it, in the shop. So it was always going to be a part of my life. I mean, as long as it stayed open, the door stayed open. Right now, I've had, due to what's happened in the world. My commitment to the shop has been more than it ever has in my entire life. And it's a weird time because it's, you know, as a whole, surfing has blossomed in this COVID world.
It's insane.
It's insane. It really is truly. And we would never have known that that was going to happen. But it's been a great, little pump of, everything into, you know, the hard goods industry, which is really the core part of surfing world, the surfboard building, the wetsuits, all those core products. You know, those are, you know, as a surfer, you know, it's an investment of a lot of time and energy. And you have to be able to, you know, when the waves are good, you'd be able to get out and go surfing, right? So a lot of jobs that are developed around that surfers have give you the freedom to be able to go, hey, the winds are offshore and the sun's out and the swell's up. I'm going surfing and be able to pull the plug.
It's really a ton of outdoor sports. Hunting this year when I was out in Montana, blew up. I did a podcast with this guy, Steve Rinella, who's the host of this show Meat Eater on Netflix. Yep. And he was telling me about the amount of new hunters that there are in the world, in Montana specifically, is just insane. Birding, apparently, like, you know, birders, people go in their backyards and just look at birds, mm-hmm. exploded because all of a sudden people are in their backyard looking up, seeing what's going on. I mean, hunting is interesting in that you have to buy a hunting license and tags, which is money that goes directly back towards conservation, mm-hmm. right? With surfing, it is so great that it helps support people who are making these hard goods, surfboards, for example, Freeline Surf Shop. In some ways, I wish that you, if you were a new surfer, you had to buy some kind of license to make sure that resource was going to be conserved. You know, it gets into a whole nother conversation, but
it does. Yeah, it does. I mean, in my experience, what has happened, at least in Santa Cruz, and Freeline Surf Shop specifically, is that, you know, I've spent, like I said, a lot of time now. I'm there every day. You know, sometimes I don't necessarily do customer service and I'll be working in the back end or, you know, taking some time back there. But what I found is that, you know, with the explosion of surfing, is that people want to do it, and they want to do it right? They want to have information, good information. So I feel like it's a responsibility, at least for me, a responsibility to be able to help these people enter, you know, the sport as safely, and not affecting, you know, the people that live here and surf here every day and,
sure.
and trying. So it's an educational process that, you know, and I'm not just trying to do it monetarily wise. I actually feel like the investment is just to have them get the right equipment to have fun, surf the right places and learn some of the etiquette that comes with it. And so it's a responsibility as an elder to help these people have a good experience and not to affect the people like the grumpy locals that are there too, right? So I feel like it's been a really good thing. It helps monetarily that the shop's doing pretty well, but also that you've got this explosion of surfers. I'm glad they're just not this clueless bunch out there, that you're trying to educate them and have them have a good experience and not affect the rest of the surfing world that have put in such a long time, and all of a sudden their local breaks infested with, you know, three times the amount of people.
Right. It's easy to look at new surfers just as cogs rather than
kooks.
They're cogs. Oh yeah, there's a word for it. Yeah. Forgot we have a word. That's what I was looking for. But really, they're highly moldable people, mm-hmm. right? They're entering into this. They want to learn. So yeah. If you can teach them etiquette, and that's, I was going to say, I think a real great part of the WSL is you have a certain amount of historical context that you bring to the sport. A lot of new surfers are looking at the WSL, and it's really their education, mm-hmm. right? What is the history of Pipeline? What's the history of a wave like the Lane? You know, you're entering. There were a lot of people who came before you. There was a culture. There is a culture. It's important to maintain that. And I think that most kooks on soft tops don't want to ruin the sport, mm-mm. right?
Well, if they fall in love with it specifically, like there's probably a few surfers that have done it and hate it and walk away and go do something else.
Right.
But the ones that get invested into it, they're going to be like so enthralled with it. They don't want to be a kook,
right? Yeah, more than anything.
Yeah, right. So I don't want to be a kook. How do I not be a kook? You know, you learn history, you respect elders, you surf the spots that you're learned to surf, you don't surf the spots that you're taught not to surf,
you know,
and you develop that. And it's also a hierarchy that's, I think, is so cool, is that you think about where surfing came from, right? It came from Hawaii. The Peruvians as well also have an interest in it, but really the royal culture of Hawaii kind of helped us shape, you know, the fact that we respect our elders. And the elders, are their responsibility is to teach the young and the new to respect their elders, but also educate and get them going the right path.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a huge culture of that in Hawaii. I remember going over to the North Shore, you know, in my early teens, and just seeing the way that kids would treat their aunties and their uncles. There's a real kind of respect and reverence that I think was lost or not nearly as focused on the mainland.
Yeah. Well, they look at natives, like, right. You know, like all across any native, you know, whether it be Indians, the Aboriginals, the Polynesians. There is a very huge, because it was about family and respect. And I'm glad, I've wished the entire world was that way. Unfortunately, there is something got lost in I don't know where it was. In Europe, they were fighting each other, maybe. It's like, I don't know.
Well, it's an obsession with youth as well that our vanity. Culture and industry, yeah, there's a lot of vanity around it. A lot of, you know, if you can't, there's a huge obsession with looks, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that part of it comes from a deep fear of death and an inability to acknowledge our mortality. So older people look closer to death. There's a lot of studies done on why people are not nice to older people, right? It's because it actually reminds them of their own mortality.
Interesting.
And I think that if you had a culture that had a better relationship with death, you could put more value on wisdom that comes from age.
Yeah. I mean, there's an example, I guess, Ram Dass, right? Ram Dass was one of those people that, you know, he allowed hallucinogenics to get him to that place quicker, because it's very, I guess it's an expansion of the mind to be able to help that. It's kind of cool. It's a little window, right?
Yep.
But Ram Dass dealt with death in a way that, I mean, he was able to help other people come to that, that death happens. We're all dying, you know, accept it. There's a level of acceptance that comes with it. Don't fear it.
Yeah. 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 How'd you come across Ram Dass? I'm a huge fan of him.
Yeah. He came to me through my wife, really. She was the one who did it, she brought his book, into our lives, you know, and all of a sudden I'm like, wow. And then listening to him speak, you know, and some of the stuff he was saying in the early 70s, wow, amazing stuff that, you know, the guy's a professor, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he's
Richard Albert.
Yeah. And he's all of a sudden he's, you know, he found hallucinogenics that all of a sudden opened up this whole expansion of his mind. And it wasn't just about getting high, bro.
Right.
It was this, wow, this stuff really has taught me a lot about life and how to live. Anyway, so and his book has got some great sayings in it that you can apply to anything in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great podcast. I'll share it with you. I think it's just called Ram Dass or Ram Dass Teachings or something. Mm-hmm. And they've taken all of these talks that he's given.
It's
so
crazy.
Many.
No, I've already gone through it. He's like, there's like 163 different podcasts or something crazy, right? So it's all his speakings.
Yeah, sit in Starflight, light a candle, meditate, and listen to Ram Dass talks.
It's cool, right?
So cool.
And some of the stuff, it's really raw.
Yeah.
The recordings are horrible sometimes. And but yeah, I'm already in on it. So
people can be very forgiving
here and now.
Of audio.
Ram Dass here and now.
Yeah, Ram Dass here and now.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, his book is called Here and Now, right, too, I think. Or anyway, but yeah, I recommend it to people. I actually turned it on to my dad.
Yeah.
Of all things. And he's like, it was hard for him at first, but then all of a sudden he's like, whoa, there's some really cool stuff in here.
Yeah. Well, about a year ago, we have a lot of really incredible spiritual teachers in Santa Cruz, some who are even legit. But there's one guy named Adi Ashanti who does meditation retreats up at a spot called Mount Madonna.
Yeah.
About a year ago, I did a week-long silent meditation with him. It's incredible the spaces of consciousness that you begin to occupy in silence for a long period of time.
And I can only imagine. I've never done it. I a lot.
Highly recommend it, man. I think that for someone like you, you would get a huge amount of value out of it. And what was it that you said Ram Dass's podcast is called?
Here and Now.
And what was it that we were talking about at the beginning of this whole podcast, man? How do you make it through big wave beatings?
Yeah.
You know, how do you make it through life and adversity?
Yeah. And he did it too. It's just amazing stuff. I mean, he was way before his time, I guess, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at what's happening with psilocybin now, the last big election, right? Psilocybin's been legalized, and it's good to see that the world is opening their eyes up to these types of things that can really help. I mean, I would say psilocybin is going to be something that can really deal with depression. And depression's been a big topic, at least recently for us in the surf world. When you look at what's happened to a guy like Sonny Garcia, you know, and John Shimoka, these two surfers, they're great people, great lives, great, you know, all of a sudden we're dealing with depression that was just, you know, you didn't know it, but they were really hurting. And so much so that they tried to take their own lives. And I think that we've got it's a major problem, you know, and I think it's going to get even more expansive, especially when we're dealing with what we're dealing with right now, COVID. We've got to find ways to deal with it, you know, and communication's part of it. But I mean, if psilocybin's one way of allowing people to get through some of these, you know, really dark times, I'm all for it.
Yeah. And it's right here in Santa Cruz, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelics, MAPS, you know, it's legit science around psychedelics, MDMA and psilocybin. And it's, you know, these are MDMA is being pushed through as a breakthrough remedy for people with PTSD, mm-hmm. soldiers. Like, that's one thing that I really like about the conversation of psychedelics is that it's bipartisan, right? You don't, it's not something like gun control, right? That's left or right, you know, yeah. And as a result, it becomes gridlocked. You can have someone who's a teacher who's suffering from depression, you know, a surfer. You can have a soldier who just came back from Iraq who's suffering from PTSD. It's like mental suffering doesn't have a political party.
No.
Right. And we've seen Oxy rip through this country. You know, it's now the number one cause of young death in America, ahead of car accidents and smoking, you know, and you see what can happen with a plant. It's actually a root, like a boga, to help people get off of opiates. Mm-hmm. You can see what ayahuasca has mm-hmm. done for people with depression, PTSD, MDMA. I mean, in some ways, I dislike calling them drugs because that term feels too small.
Yeah, and it also has the stereotype to it, right?
Right.
The unfortunate thing is like, oh, drugs, they're bad.
Right.
Right? Drugs are bad.
Exactly.
And even, you know, you talk about oxys. There's an example of something that, you know, is a drug that's supposed to numb pain, right? Which, you know, all of a sudden it's very addictive and it's very dangerous.
Yeah.
And so... a thing like psilocybin, I don't think there's something where you're all of a sudden you're like going to abuse it, right? It doesn't feel like.
Yeah, I don't know if you, I don't know how much you've done it, but it's definitely not one of those ones that you like do and are like, I want to do more. You're like, oh, how, I want to journal for 3 days.
Right. No, I understand that. And I mean, these days I am what I'm quote unquote clean and sober, right?
Right.
But I'm not anymore because I do use marijuana as a avenue of relaxation, and so cannabis is something that I've now use. I don't abuse it, and it's not, again, like I've when I was a kid or younger, I guess, you know, that it, you use that as a way to have fun, yeah. and laugh and whatever like that. It wasn't something I was using as a clinical way to take care of myself.
Sure.
Which is now I kind of look at that as like, okay, I'm going to take 15 milligrams of a gummy to allow my body to relax and focus. Cool. That, yeah. So be it, you know. But I'm not going to take 30 to go and start drooling.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that, look, anything from weed to psychedelics, if you take them at the wrong time in your life for the wrong reasons, they can really fuck you up.
Yeah.
And I've seen kids who I went to high school with who were eating mushrooms consistently and they became dull.
Like, but it was not using it as a way to escape. Right?
Exactly.
Right. And not using it in a way to, as a way to deal with an issue.
Yeah. And I think, I think it can be most helpful for people, a lot of these remedies, as they've become older, as they know mm-hmm. themselves, as some of these mental pathways have been grooved, you know, and they need to then get out of that. But when you're in high school, you're still trying to figure yourself out. Yeah. You don't need that stuff in your life. Like, you can maintain sobriety and your mind is still getting blown every day from all these new experiences.
Yeah.
Right. But as you get older, you know, in your 50s, that kind of thing, like, I think that, I mean, my dad is in his 70s and he loves weed. I think it's helped him a ton. Right. And he was never like a habitual stoner, but I think that it can be really.
But I mean, I remember as a kid, you were very straight and narrow. Right. I mean,
yeah, I didn't, my parents said that they would, I'd freaking
I remember
awesome.
This was something, right? You had a deal, right?
I had a deal with my parents. Yeah. I had a deal. They were like, we'll give you a trip anywhere you want to go when you're 18 if you don't do any drugs until then.
And so they were understanding that your developing mind
your brain
way better to get through it. You're already going to deal with puberty.
Yeah, totally. That's a hell of a drug.
Yeah. You don't need to have weed intermixed in and alcohol and cocaine and or anything else in there just to frazzle it.
For
right?
sure, man. It's and I, you know, look, you don't see it then, but looking back on it now, our group of friends became fractured by who started doing drugs mm-hmm. in high school and who didn't. And I'm really grateful that I had surfing and I had, you know, filmmaking, you know, but my buddy Kyle Boothman actually got me into surfing when I was 11 years old. Like, we would go skate together. And then one day he put a surfboard in my hands. And that was like really when I got into surfing. I totally credit Boothman for helping me fall in love with that. And then when we were in high school, we both got really interested in filmmaking as well. And I'm so happy that we had those two creative avenues to keep us out of the bad stuff.
Culture too, though. I mean, that's unfortunately the stereotype of a surfer.
Right.
You know, you look at, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, like you were already labeled as a surfer, unfortunately, that you were going to be this stoner,
sure.
You know, where I don't think that's necessarily truly the case. But the culture as a whole was very, you know, we partied and that was part of it, you know.
Sure.
And I wish I would have taken my time and not done that, because it affected me negatively, I think. I mean, I got drunk drivings, I did stupid stuff as a youngster, and that's, if I didn't have the alcohol doing that, I probably would have been a little bit better grades. And
do you feel at all like when you were coming up in Santa Cruz, the party lifestyle was also more glamorized from the industry?
Yeah. I mean, if you were to look at some of the brands that were during that era, yeah, it was part of it. But I also looked at my elders, and my right. elders were somebody that I, you know, was, okay, this is how you do it, right?
Right.
You focused on the fact that, and as a whole, yeah, there was a lot of partying going on. I mean, even on tour.
Yep.
And, you know, that's like, you look at John Shimoka, like, as a, you know, he had to go through all that adversity too, because they were on tour, they were just partying. That's what they did. So it was part of the culture.
Right.
Right. And that's where you're looking at those people as teachers.
Right. Yeah. I got to also tip my hat to Nat Young in our generation for being someone who got to a very high level in surfing and also had that kind of clean athletic look, because mm-hmm. I think that it's not like asking whether or not you're going to quote unquote make it as a pro surfer isn't really the right question to be asking. You know, there's going to be a million kids who come up, fall in love with surfing and never can make a living at it.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you maintain a healthy relationship with it?
Yeah.
Right. And how do you have it not destroy your life? How do you have it be this really, fun and even sacred activity to help push you forward, you know? And I think that a lot of it has to do with a lot of the other substances that you either get involved with or don't through the surfing world.
Yeah.
And I think that Nat has done that for a lot of kids coming up, you know, like the industry is not providing huge paychecks for kids, even though there's a lot of young ones shredding in town. But from my eye, a lot of them are doing very well. You know, they're learning other skills. Like, you look at a kid like Willem Banks, who's a shredding surfer, getting huge waves at Mavericks, and also, you know, training in carpentry, you know, and he's very much excelling in other avenues. You know, someone like Sean Burns as well, like, great surfer, went to college learning other skills. And I think that that's a really cool path to walk. And I think that Nat was very influential in showing that path.
And he's becoming an elder.
Yeah.
And so that's where people are looking up to him. Okay, how do I, you know, carve my path? You know, I'm going to train. You know, he took a very professional avenue as far as, you know, being a true athlete. You know, he subsidized not just, you know, surfed many, many, many hours, but he also went to the gym. And, you know, and he became very strong, and he focused, and he, you know, So he had some great success, you know, and you're right. Luckily, I think there's something that can be said about the fact that there's not these huge paychecks and given out there nowadays that, you know, you kind of have to, you know, figure it out. You got to have your eggs, several eggs in the basket, not just just the one.
Right. Hell yeah, man.
Pretty good, huh?
Always really enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, same. We went all over the place. I like it, though. That's how it works.
That's one of my favorite things about this podcast, is I can get Pete Mel talking about Ram Dass.
Yeah, I think we chatted about him before, but yeah, he's, I'm 51. There's 55 decades of experiences that you go through in life, and to be able to share it with you and with everyone else who listened to this, so it's pretty neat. You know, stoked that you've had great successes, and you know, this is a pretty cool little avenue that you've got going on here, especially here in the Starflight.
It's fun, man. It's fun. And I gotta say, I saw your wave from the channel, and it was fucking dope, dude.
You came out of it stoked, right? Like, you're like pretty happy about it, right?
That's so happy.
So weird how that is. Like, cause sometimes, like, if I were 25 years ago, I'd seen, like, say somebody else get that wave, I'd be like, oh man, why wasn't it me? You know, but oh man, it's neat. And that was the kind of the vibe I think that carried out there that day specifically, was that everyone was genuinely stoked for each other. The vibe was so cool.
Huge. And that's what's so special to me about Mavericks. Sure, it's like, yeah, if you get a couple bombs, you're psyched. It's the best feeling ever. But that community is real. Mm-hmm. And it's been such a special thing for me to be able to, like, make really good friends through that community. Like, I can honestly say that some of my best friends are big wave surfers. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, you go through that. It's in some ways, you know, I think that you can develop deeper relationships with people because you go through a system, a moment of adversity, a day of adversity, and then you come out the other end. Mm-hmm. Like, it can kind of forge that depth in an expedited way.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why I think the best part of big wave surfing is when it's all said and done, right?
Totally.
When it's all said and done, and you're able to just kind of sit in it and reflect, and you know, fist bump a friend of yours. You don't even have to talk about it. It's just a feeling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, man, ton of respect for you, Pete Mel.
Thanks. Ton of respect for you.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it. It was just really cool. Thank you.
See ya.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.